Okay, we are talking about Bishul, cooking on Shabbat, and we talked about rabbinic concern number one, which is you might come to increase the flame. What's the second concern? You're engaging in an activity, let's say on an open flame. You let it cook on its own, or you took something out, which is cold, which has been cooked from before Shabbat, which is dry, which you can reheat, but I reheated it on an open flame. Let's say I had the flame on from before Shabbat started, and it's an open flame. Am I doing anything wrong on the biblical level?
No.
If you don't adjust it.
No, because why? If you don't adjust it, yeah. You don't adjust the flame, it's and the food has already been cooked.
It's already done.
Yeah, it's already
so what's the concern?
That you may lower it or...
We did that already. You may lower it or to get it. You know,
if you're cooking, you put it back on.
So the second concern is it's called mechsei kevavashel. It looks like you're cooking. It's not marasayin though. Why don't we want to do something that looks like it's cooking?
Someone's assuming that you're cooking.
Forget about other people.
Well, for ourselves, it feels like we're cooking. So that actually cooking doesn't feel that different.
Good. Good.
Oh, okay.
The concern is if you do something which so closely resembles the prohibited activity, the rabbis are concerned that what? You might end up doing the prohibited activity itself. Now, I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
And we had this little conversation, I think, on the retreat a little, that I'm a very disciplined person. So don't pull me over the side of the on the highway and say you were running, you know, I'll give you the example. This is the example I like to use. Why do we have 55-mile or 65-mile-per-hour speed limits when a lot of people can drive 80 miles an hour very carefully? Why?
Some people can't.
Enough people can't. Okay, good. Now, if you get pulled over doing 90 and you take out your speed car racing card to prove to the cop that you are a professional speed car racer and you drive at 110, 120 miles an hour like it's nothing, so driving 90, does he still give you a ticket? Why? Besides admission. I mean, he's got it on his odometer.
Right.
Why?
It's not about you. It's about the principle.
The public.
Okay, no, but
it's to protect everyone.
His driving 90 is maybe safer than a guy driving 60.
Yeah, but still, it makes it seem like other people are allowed to do that.
Okay, you can't have a legal system with different people doing different things. It, by definition, ceases to be a legal system. So whenever I always mention these types of things, and people are listening, and they're like, okay, that's great. That's for undisciplined, sloppy people who might come to increase the flame. I'm not having company this Shabbat, so who am I increasing the flame for? Doesn't apply to me. Or, you know what, I can act closely to the prohibited activity without actually crossing the line. You might be able to, and the truth is, you might be one of those people. But we can't have a legal system, and the rabbis created these rules and these laws for the populace, for the general populace. So that's why I'm just trying to give you a little philosophy behind the law, why we have these. Now, what takes care of these two things so we can have hot food on Shabbos?
Blech.
The blech. I don't know who came up with that. Blech?
Hot plate.
Hot plate. Now, what does the blech do, and how does, or a hot plate? Plug-in hot plate. What does a plug-in hot plate or a blech do to get around those two rabbinic concerns?
Fire.
Well, the fire is on already. We're only talking about rabbinic concern, not biblical.
It is a cover.
The biblical concern is turning. We're not dealing with the biblical concern. You already put it on.
It doesn't show the actual flame.
Okay. It covers the flame.
You don't.
So how does it get rid of concern number one?
It doesn't look like you're actually cooking. It
doesn't look like you're cooking, number one. And what? And what's number two?
You don't change the temperature.
How is it going to prevent you from increasing or decreasing if company comes over?
Because you can't see it.
It is possible. The knob's right there.
You can't just see it.
What's that?
You
can see the flame. You can't see the flame, but you can see the knob. So how does it prevent you from doing it? I'm pushing you a little. How does it prevent you from coming to increase or decrease the flame?
Because it looks different.
Thank you. It's just a heck hair.
That's it.
It just looks different. It's a reminder. It's like a little ribbon on your nose to go with Shabbos. You know what I'm saying? Okay, so that is, so what does that permit you to do? What does that permit you to do, guys? What kind of food can you heat up?
Solids.
Solids which have been cooked from before Shabbat. So give me examples.
Chicken.
Brisket. Vegetables. Kugels. Kugel. Fish. All this stuff. Why is it different by liquid?
You're changing the form.
Because what is cooking when it comes to a liquid, actually? Okay, but you know what? When a soup cools down, it's still edible. What is cooking when it comes to a liquid? It's just boiling. It's just getting it to a certain temperature. So if you get it to a certain temperature, you've cooked, and then it goes down, right? So reheating when it comes to a liquid is actually cooking. Reheating when it comes to a solid is not cooking, it's reheating.
What if you don't hit like a boiling point? Water.
Ah, that's very good. So if you would actually reheat something, a liquid, and it doesn't get, you only take like the cooling out of it, you warm it up, but you don't get it to a certain level of temperature, which is called yad soledet bo, which means if I touch it with my finger, I have to recoil, it's that hot. It's not considered cooking.
So how come that is allowed? So you're allowed to play with that, and you cannot play with other things.
Because you're not cooking then.
You're also going close to a line, just like when we're saying...
Right, but that...
Do you have soup that on Shabbos Day, you're telling me?
No, but you're allowed, I'll tell you what you can do. Let's say something is really cold and it's liquid. You can put it near a flame, you can put it near a covered flame to take the chill out of it a little.
But you can't put it like on the hot plate.
No, if you put it on the hot plate, well, the truth is you could, I guess, and pull it off when it gets warm. But you're not permitted to...
Or if it's on a black and there's only a flame in the back corner, like can you put it in the front?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. As long as there's a blech, you're fine. But the concern is that you're going to leave it there and it's just going to boil. And if it boils, you've cooked. And then that's a biblical prohibition. So what you want to do is you can do it a little to get the, take the chill out a little.
So could you, like, if you wanted to put it up, is boiling like the first bubble? Or like, you know, at what point?
What point is it boiling? Hot enough
you
that...
If you record,
so we're not talking about the boiling point of water.
No, we're talking about like if you're able to put it... As long as you're...
It's like it's less than 200.
You recoil well before boiling.
Yeah, yeah. We're saying that that point is just like when it transforms.
So there's a machlokas. I think some say it's 160 degrees. You know, it's different.
There's something hot. You don't have
yeah. Correct. I'm sorry?
It drains your battery.
Okay, guys. Well, what is... Okay. We're good. All right. Last thing. Just turn the page. Page 2. You guys have it here. You see the rabbinic enactments? You see it says 2 concerns. Lest one come to stalk the calls. 2 looks as though one is cooking. Guys, you got this. You're making this hard for me. No little schmoozes on the side of your mind. I'm sorry. I have to talk to you like 5-year-olds. 1, lest one come to stalk the coals. 2, looks as though one is cooking. So therefore, from a fridge to an open flame, allowing food to cook on its own. And then, I'm not going to go through those other things right now, but as long as it's a dry item, it's been fully cooked, you can put it on something, on a hot plate, or something that has a blech on it. That's it. Let's keep it simple. Question?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Tea
or coffee. So this is very interesting. So there's a whole debate about tea bags. I personally use tea bags on Shabbat. Tea bags are very easily cooked. They're tea leaves, and they get very easily cooked. But as long as you don't dip your tea bag in either a kli rishon or what's called a kli sheni, I'll use these to demonstrate. Actually, can somebody, you might do me a favor, can you just grab me 3 cups, 3 plastic cups, would you mind? It'll be much easier for me to demonstrate this. So the Talmud says, thank you, the Talmud says that, what's a kli rishon? What's a first vessel?
Like the hot water.
Right, the vessel in which you cook the item. So that could be a pot, it could be a hot water urn, it could be a kettle. Okay, if you were to take a tea bag or something and dip it in there, what would you be doing after you boiled water?
Cooking it.
It'd be cooking. What if you took some hot water from there, poured it into a second cup?
You're not cooking it.
So technically, the Talmud says kli sheni, a kli is a vessel, second vessel. That's the vessel in which you pour it. Einam avashal does not have the same capacity to cook like a first vessel does. It's just the nature of... I mean, we can get into the mechanics or the physics of it, but it's basically because the item was not cooked in there, it doesn't have the same heating capacity. However, when it comes to certain very easily cooked items, like a tea bag, the Talmud calls those items Kali Hamavashel. Kali means light, easily light, cooked easily. When it comes to a Kali Hamavashel, you shouldn't even, the rabbis say you should be careful not even to put it in a second vessel, thank you very much, but into a third. So let's make, this is my stove. No, let's use my beer. This is a stove, this is the heat, and here's the first vessel. Okay, and I boil the water in there, okay? So how do I want to have coffee or tea on Shabbat. So what do?
Take it out of the hot water, pour it in.
Take it out of here. Pour it into here, okay? Now, in here, I theoretically could put my tea bag in there, but we're a little strict when it comes to tea bags because tea bags get so easily cooked. Here's the third vessel. Take it from here, pour it into here, and then dip the tea bag in there, or the same thing with coffee, even if it's instant coffee. The only thing you can't really do, and I'll say this in a minute, there is a way to have freshly brewed coffee on Shabbat. But I'm not going to mention it. I just want to make sure everybody gets that here. So if you're doing instant coffee or instant tea or a tea bag, this is the first vessel. It's cooking on here. This is the flame. You take some of here, pour it in here. That's the second vessel. Normally, I should be able to do whatever I want in this thing, according to the Talmud. But because tea leaves are so easily cooked, put it in here, and then you can have. Now, some people are very strict, and they won't use tea leaves at all. They use tea essence. I don't think you have to go to that extreme. Whatever it is, it's not such an extreme. I actually grew up doing that. My mother was trained to do that. And then when I learned this, and I saw that some great rabbis were using tea bags on Shabbos, so I changed it. Question.
So Sephardi, I learned that, and again, like, I don't know, I still mixed up about this and understanding why, but we don't do the second vessel. Unless I'm...
I never heard that.
Yemeni.
So it's not... So for everybody, it's a second vessel?
Everybody, yeah. Okay. This is in Talmud.
We don't do a third.
This is not subject.
Okay.
No, some people don't do a third either, Ashkenaz or Sephard. I don't think there's a distinction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim.
Can I ask...
Yeah.
But isn't the fact that, like, the tea itself is not edible, like, shouldn't that be part of it? Like, what's cooking
is
like, you don't...
Oh, there's spices?
Like, you don't eat the tea bag. You eat, like, the water that, like, comes out of it.
The flavoring that emerges from the tea leaves. They're leaves. But they're considered a food. They're considered a food. So you're cooking them. I mean, that's a good question because...
It's, like, different than the carrot case.
It's different than the carrot case.
You're not eating the thing that gets cooked. It's, like, a byproduct.
But you're extracting there for what?
To drink it.
You're extracting the flavor from it. Kevin's trying to figure out if there's an extra one there for him.
Which does?
Not for me.
Yeah, I don't know. Just make sure there's enough for them because they get very, very angry. It's a very angry fellowship here.
Yeah, people are missing
bread.
You
can take bread.
Or
so then why then do some Sephardi eat? Why does Sephardi like dip the tea bag then? Like
everybody dips the tea bag.
I know.
As opposed to like submerging the
tea. Like submerging and leaving it.
Well, why do you put the tea bag in after? Is that like a Shabbat thing or is that your...
That is a Shabbat thing. You're not supposed to pour the hot water on the tea bag because that cooks the tea leaves. Where it's called Iroi Mikli Rishon. That's another way of actually cooking, which is to pour something hot over something. So it's better for the hot thing to already be in the cup. And then dip. So dipping is a Shabbos thing. What about coffee? How would you actually have freshly brewed coffee on Shabbos?
Like a little pour over.
Before I get to that. I was going to get to that.
You like elite, like the
pour over.
Elite is instant.
You're talking about like
freshly ground brewed coffee. How would you have it on Shabbos?
You buy a thing of iced coffee before?
Cold brew.
Cold brew.
I thought you could do
not cold, hot, freshly brewed coffee. Thank you.
Oh, you put it in a slow cooker.
A timer.
You can do that.
Just
like you do the air conditioner.
Why is it different than the air conditioner?
And the lighting system. Am I allowed to do that with food as well?
Does everyone hold that way?
No.
I mean,
the big rabbis do.
No,
I learned this on a rabbinic conference. I was with 35 other rabbis in Baltimore. We went to see Rav Heineman. He's one of the great rabbinic kashrut. If you heard of the Chafke or the Oke, I think he's the Chafke. And somebody raised his hand and said, Rabbi, is it true that you said we could set a timer on a coffee machine? How is that okay? So the rabbi looked back at the young rabbi who asked the question and said, what's the name of your coffee machine? He said, Keurig. He said, last time I checked, there was nothing in the Torah about Keurig cooking, not cooking on Shabbos. The issue is, in other words, and therefore, you can set a timer in order for that to happen. Do you have to do this? People who are like diehard, love coffee, you know. Khani, is everything okay?
Yeah.
Oh. What was that?
Where's Carol?
Oh, she left.
She wasn't feeling well. If you could give her the contact information. Thank you.
What was it just saying?
Keurig.
Okay, the other thing is I found this thing. What's the name of the company? I bought this for my wife.
Nespresso
just came out with a weird kind of cute little thing in its own package. It was not cheap, but it allows you to...
Cool.
My wife's addicted to coffee and good coffee. We're coffee snobs. She is. I follow along. And I don't even know how to explain it, but I watched the YouTube. I sent it to Pinny. He watched the YouTube. We put our heads together and we said it was okay.
Where is there a timer on?
There's no timer.
What is it?
You like,
how do you do it?
Oh, I should have brought it in.
You can crank the...
it's up.
Yeah, it's like a little thing like this big. It's like this big. And you like crank it and it like goes and basically the...
But the hot water you have to have heated from before Shabbos. You have to have hot water from before Shabbos. You put the hot water in this one little shmigegegi thing. Take water from the urn, put it in this one part of the shmigegegi thing. Then you keep going.
And then, like, the grounds go in another part. And basically, instead of... She was saying, like, you can't separate, like, right? Because you can't separate between... But because you're taking
the good from the bad.
The good from the bad, then it's okay.
You can use it, espresso.
It's not the actual part of the machine.
So wait, how does it espresso?
It's like it does. It's like you crank it. I don't know how else to explain it. It's not even that big.
It's like the real part of the machine.
No, it's a handheld.
I know what it feels. You see, I'm glad you used the word feeling, because facts don't care about your feelings. We talked about that, and that is a really important aspect when it comes to Shabbos and halacha in general. Remember, I told you this story about the crazy guy who threatened to kill himself if the rabbi wouldn't give him a heter, abortion, and he went to Rabbi Salvechik. The reason it's such a funny story, Rabbi Salvechik's response, tell the man to shoot himself, halacha will not be taken hostage by pistol, because what these rabbis were known for were being very about the rule and about the law. It's not about your feelings, not about your emotions. Now, I will tell you something. I met with a young woman just last week who came applying for a position here. She's 21 years old. She's like the world... She represents the United States in the Olympics on ping pong. Her name is Esty Ackerman. Do you know her? Ping pong. Table tennis, we call it?
Yeah, I know.
And she's a 20...
Gymnastics.
Right, so she came to my office last week. We met. She's a student of my teacher, and my teacher, Rabbi Schachter, said, you got to meet with her. She's unbelievable, not just because of ping pong. She's going to become a great Torah scholar. So I met with her, and she's awesome. I'm going to try to get her to come and speak. And I said to her... She said, well, you know, she became a little, like, famous because she wouldn't play the ping pong Friday night. And I was like, the only time I played ping pong when I was a kid was on Shabbos. Like, there's nothing wrong with playing ping pong on Shabbos. So when she was 16 years old, 15, 16. She got, like, to the top thing, the top, Friday night. And she said no. Because she said, and she's like a modern Orthodox, there's photographers, it just didn't feel like in the spirit of Shabbat. It's not the way I want to spend my Shabbos. And she knew full well that technically she could have played. You know what I mean? It's
like word for her.
Well, she didn't use that word. She said, like, I want my Shabbos to be spiritually, and when I'm playing ping pong competitively, and there's photographers, and there's reporters, and it's a whole big thing, that's not the way we spend Shabbos. Even though technically, would she have been violating anything? No, not even rabbinic, probably. Now, I'm not saying that's like you have to do that. You don't have to do that. But But the feelings do come in. But when it comes to these things, we want to keep it light. Now, I want to hit you guys up with one last thing. We're done with cooking, which I've never done in such a record breaking because you give me no time, and then you just. I mean, it's not your fault, really. No, your questions are excellent.
Jamie has a question.
Jamie, go ahead.
In the very beginning, you said microwaving was fine, so you didn't change things. I'd like to go against that with popcorn. Because with popcorn, you can't eat those kernels, but if you put it in the microwave and you pop it,
No. It's not besides the point. That's actually the answer. Okay. You raised a good question, and Zoe just gave you a good answer. Because you're saying you're changing the status of, but you're not using classic heat. You're using what's a microwave?
Radiation.
Radiation. It's not really classic fire heat.
It's no heat.
No, I'm not saying it is. There are other problems with it. But I was just saying that it may not fulfill the classic definition of heat. So you're right. Even though the radiation will result in a changed item. But in order for you to be in violation of Bishul on Shabbos, you have to be involved in classic heating. And microwave is not classic heating. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we still can't use it on Shabbat. But it's not for that reason.
But what if, I will get to this now, but what if the non-Jew
can use it? No, that's the next thing. Good. Okay, good. So,
tea. So if you're pouring it in the first cup,
You're not pouring it. First cup, the first vessel is the thing in which it's cooked in.
If you're supplying it from like a
hot urn. This is the urn.
Is the urn the same as like
the first vessel?
The urn itself is the first vessel.
Correct. That's the item. That's the vessel in which it's cooked.
So then, even after that,
we're supposed to pour it into another one.
The second, and then the third. Just for tea. Just for tea. All right.
For coffee. Only tea. Instant coffee
has also been made to. You should use the third also for coffee.
Is this a silly question? Can you apply the same vessel stepping idea to like you have a cup of boiling water and you want to dip a piece of steak in there?
Technically, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you could figure out how to cook your steak in a second vessel, there's into hate, man. I don't want a piece of that thing though.
Okay,
this next topic I usually leave an entire class for this. Okay, have you done anything against the Torah by asking your good friend Bob, who is not Jewish, to do something for you on Shabbos that you otherwise couldn't do yourself? Push the elevator button, cook some food for you, whether it's biblical or rabbinic. I'm saying on the Torah level.
Yes.
What?
Because you could have done it yourself. If it has to be in a certain time, like if you're asking for them to do it right now.
Biblical. What have you violated? The only thing biblical in the Torah for Shabbos is 39 acts of work. What of the 39 acts of work are involved with asking a non-Jew to do something you can't do yourself? Zero.
What if there's
a
negotiation involved?
Also rabbinic, not biblical.
What about asking a Jew, then, is not one of the 39?
Okay, that's a different problem, actually. You're not permitted to cause or lead a Jew to do something which is sin, even if they're not observant. So when people, I don't keep Shabbos, I'll push the button for you.
If a non-Jew is part of your household, wouldn't that be a biblical? So some say yes.
That's a very good point, because there is a verse in the Torah that says, who rests on Shabbos?
Not only your slave, but your maidservant.
So according to some, if they were actually in your employ, it might be an issue. We're going to talk about employees as well. But the rabbis came along. I'm sorry, I got to do this.
No worries.
The rabbis came along, and for one of three reasons, not to make our lives difficult, they said, don't rely on non-Jews to do things for you on Shabbat that you otherwise can do for yourself, with exceptions. And I'm going to go through those exceptions in a few moments. Remember, whenever the rabbis instituted some new rule or law, they wanted it doable. They wanted it reasonable. So they embedded exceptions into the rule. Those aren't loopholes, guys. Those are ways that it'll make it doable for us to actually observe this. Because if I told you right now, under no circumstances can you ever ask a non-Jew or benefit from the work of a non-Jew on Shabbat, that's really hard to keep. The rabbis wanted to prevent certain things from happening, but they also wanted it doable. So follow with me. According to the Rambam, the great Maimonides, the Rambam says that the reason that you're not supposed to rely on non-Jewish help on Shabbat is that so Shabbos should not be taken lightly. Because let's say you have hired help, and they can do everything for you. Pretty soon, it doesn't take a lot of smarts to figure out what you can't do. And they'll just put on the light for you, they'll put the TV on, they'll do this, they'll do that, and pretty soon, Shabbos will just cease to be the holy, sanctified place it is. And once you get used to being in that environment and your non-Jewish friend isn't around, the concern is you'll end up just doing it yourself because you're so used to having it done for you. That's A. That's the Rambam's reason. Rashi gives a completely... You guys know Rashi was Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who lived in France, spent some time in Germany, in the 1100s. Rambam lived later. Maimonides lived in the... 1100s in Spain. Rashi said that it's part of things you're not supposed to say on Shabbos. Do you know that there are certain things we're not supposed to speak about on Shabbat? This is rabbinic. Even though we have a verse in the Torah that says it, but the verse is not found in the five books. And when a verse is not found in the five books, it's found in the rest of the Tanakh. So it has a great status, but it doesn't have a biblical status, even though it's part of the Bible. God bless you. But it's only the five books of Moses that we learn laws from. Okay? There is a verse in the book of Isaiah. Have you ever heard of Isaiah, the great prophet? He said, if you will restrain your feet because of Shabbat, you will honor it by not engaging in your accustomed ways, pursuing your interests, or discussing the forbidden. What does it mean, discussing the forbidden? What's forbidden to be discussed on Shabbos? It's not a lot, by the way. It's just business, basically. Money matters.
And like bad plans, right?
I guess you're not. That's a good point. You're not supposed to be sad on Shabbos. So there is a story in the Talmud of Rabbi Meir who lost a son and he died on Shabbos and he wasn't aware of it. His wife Bruria, who was a great Torah scholar in her own right, she did not tell her husband until Shabbos was out that their son had died because she didn't want him to be sad on Shabbos. Now, I'm not saying we rule that way. These are very high-level people. But that's true. We're not supposed to be overly sad. Now, does that mean there was a terrible earthquake in Turkey, of course? Thousands of people were killed. It's like beyond catastrophic. So, I mean, I don't think it's inappropriate to speak about on Shabbat, especially if you want to pray for people who are injured. And, you know, we should do something on Shabbat, about that. But you want to be careful and mindful about not getting too sad on Shabbos. But I think it's just business. I love when people say, that's Lashon Hara. You can't speak Lashon Hara on Shabbos. What's Lashon Hara? Like, you know, bad things, you know, bad mouthing somebody. Right? That's not a, that is a prohibition all the time. You know, so it's really just business. Just business.
Is he at a point where can you discuss what's going to happen for any upcoming week?
I forgot to say. So, I'll talk about your upcoming week thing. So what does it have to do with telling a non-Jew something? So he says that just like there are certain things you're not supposed to speak about on Shabbat, we're not even supposed to talk about the malachos that we're not doing. You hear? In other words, we're not engaging in certain activities. So by asking a non-Jew, do me a favor, put the light on for me. I'm a crazy Sabbath observant Jew. It's dark in here. Put the light on. Or they know already that the light, you know, that you can't put the light on. They're friends of yours. Oh, they flick it on for you. You're not supposed to take benefit. You're actually technically supposed to leave the room. You're not supposed to have benefit from it, according to the rabbis. Why? Because it's the language. That's where, by the way, the hinting comes in. Some people have like heard about like hinting, you can hint to somebody. Yeah. Under certain limited circumstances, if it falls under one of the exceptions, I'll get to it in a minute. Okay? Three, shlichus. Concept of agency. What is a shliach? What's a shliach, guys? Did you hear that?
Messenger.
You ever hear like a Chabad guy considers himself a a shaliach of the Rebbe? A messenger. What's a messenger? So all the lawyers in the room should start thinking things. What is the role of a... Harry, what is agency?
It's manifested by a mutual agreement of the principal.
Okay. He just wind them up. Now, but... What is the relationship between the messenger and the person who asked the messenger to do the work?
Like an extension.
Is this the household idea?
Oh, it's as if they're doing it themselves. That's what I was
principal.
No, not that, but...
It's as if they're doing it themselves.
Thank you. Shlucho shel Adam kamoso, the Talmud says. A shaliach is like the person themselves. And we know that in criminal law. You can't say, well, I didn't kill him. I paid somebody $10,000 to kill him. But, you know, right? So the person's an extension. So these are the three reasons. Now, does everyone have the three reasons? Guys? One second. So Shabbos not to be taken lightly. You might come to do it yourself. Forbidden speech. Or agency. I'm going to plug in on the bottom now. See if you guys are listening. The prohibition includes four things. I want you to tell me which one of these three principles is involved. Number one, asking an non-Jew on Shabbos to perform a melacha for you. Which one? One, two, or three, or and?
All of them.
Two, all of them.
Three, especially.
Right. One, two, and three, because agency?
Yeah.
Right? Forbidden speech. Shabbos not to be taken lightly. Okay? All right, all three.
Four.
What about asking an non-Jew on Shabbat to perform a melacha after Shabbos? Harry, you were asking about this.
Just speech.
So it's just speech. What about so Shabbos will not be taken lightly? No, it's not happening for you on Shabbos. What about agency? It's not happening for you on Shabbos. Good. Three, asking a non-Jew on a weekday, like on Tuesday, to perform a melacha for you on Saturday, on Shabbos.
One and three.
One,
right, because it's going to happen for you on Shabbos. Is it forbidden speech? No, because when did you use the speech? Tuesday. Not on Shabbos, not a problem. But it is a problem for Shlicha. So that's why, depending on what you believe is the reason for the sages instituting these rules, will determine whether or not it is forbidden or not. So turn the page, please, to pay the next page. So, number one...
What about four?
Oh, benefiting from...
Right?
I forgot. What? No. What did we say before? You gave the example, you're sitting in a dark room, somebody puts a light on for you. Benefiting from a melacha performed...
It's not any of those.
One second. Benefiting from a melacha performed by a non-Jew on his own initiative. It's certainly not forbidden speech. You didn't say anything. Is it agency? No, you didn't put him up to it. But isn't it one?
No, because you didn't do it. They did it.
Yeah, but what's the issue? What's one, though? When you get benefit from something, you what? When you get benefit from something, you what? You get used to it, and then that's the concern that the Rambam was giving
us.
So
what's your opinion? Why is it okay about like
that?
We're going to get to it. We're going to get to it. Now. We're going to get to it.
What about hotels with the keys?
I'm going to get to all this stuff. Just stay with me, guys. Okay. Leniencies. Now, I told you that embedded within the rules are exceptions. There are two types of exceptions to amira la'akum. Amira means speaking. Akum is someone not Jewish. Different ways of referring to non-Jews. Nachri, akum, goy, whatever. What do I mean by a leniency on a rabbinic level versus a leniency on a biblical level? Meaning, I need you to pay attention for this. The next four cases, situations, is that, let's say, for a mitzvah, to prevent substantial financial loss, considerable pain, or human dignity, it would be okay to ask a non-Jew or to benefit from a non-Jew who's doing something for you that otherwise, if you did it, would be rabbinically prohibited. I'll say it again. The next four situations would permit you to ask a non-Jew to do something which would otherwise be something which would be rabbinically prohibited. Now, you could figure this out because you're starting to be able to tell the difference. Are you not between biblical and rabbinic? You just got to keep... What's biblical, guys? 39 melacha. Nothing else is biblical when it comes to Shabbat. In terms of negative, okay? Leniencies on a biblical level are In those six instances, settling Israel, twilight, inevitable consequence, illness, public mitzvah, possibility of widespread transgression. I'll go through each one. You got to give me a few minutes. We'll do it quickly. Those six instances, it would be permissible to ask a non-Jew to violate something for you on Shabbat, which on the biblical level. Meaning that the thing you're asking them to do, if you were to do it yourself, you would be in violation of something biblical, as opposed to rabbinic. You following this a little? Does this make any sense? Okay, it's going to make more sense as we go through the examples. Mitzvah. Leniencies are on a biblical level, and this will answer your question about the elevator. Why is it okay for us to take an elevator on Shabbos? Depending on what you're doing. So number one, for a mitzvah. It would be okay, if there's a mitzvah involved, to ask someone who is not Jewish to do something that if you were to do that thing, it would be in violation of not a biblical rule of Shabbat, but a rabbinical rule. What are you doing when you get into the elevator? Even if you're not asking Danny, who operates the elevator, let's say on Saturday mornings here, you know, you walk in, Danny knows to bring you up to the 10th floor. What's Danny doing by pushing the elevator button? Right, but what's he actually involved in? Is it a biblical prohibition? If you were to push the button yourself, would you be in violation of a biblical prohibition or rabbinic?
Rabbinic.
It's rabbinic. Why
Isn't
is it rabbinic?
Isn't it lighting a flame?
It's not.
It's not.
Because electricity, which is what powers the elevator, electricity, according to almost all comments, all is biblical unless it involves heat or light.
Or is it rabbinic?
It's rabbinic unless it involves heat or light. If it involves heat or light, it's biblical. Even though, now, the heat or light it produces, okay, by the way, people spend years studying this stuff, so don't, like, worry if you don't get every little, if it produces, but you need to focus, if it produces heat or light, it's got to be intended to produce heat or light. The little elevator button goes on, that's incidental. You're not pushing the button so the light goes on, you're pushing the button to take you up to the 10th floor. Are you pushing the elevator, but it does produce some heat. Are you getting in the elevator to produce heat?
No.
No. What are you getting in the elevator to do? Go upstairs. The fact that it produces heat and produces some light, that gets knocked down to rabbinic level because in order for you to be in violation of anything on the biblical level, it has to be intentional, deliberate, constructive, and productive. It goes back to our first class on Shabbos. Right? So therefore, asking someone who isn't Jewish to take you, now what's the mitzvah involved in coming up to the 10th floor?
You're sure.
You're going to pray.
On Shabbat.
You're going to do what? You're on we can come up with a couple of things that we do here on the 10th floor every Shabbos that is a mitzvah.
But unless you're disabled, you don't need the elevator to do the mitzvah.
But it doesn't matter. If there's a mitzvah involved, as long as there's a mitzvah involved, even if you don't need it. Now, I would say, but here's the other thing. Let's say there wasn't a mitzvah. Let's say there wasn't a mitzvah. Look, what about your apartment? You live on the 20th floor. Do you have to walk up 20 flights? Can you take the elevator?
Well, maybe you're going to host Shabbos.
If you're hosting a Shabbat meal, or you're doing something else that's a mitzvah, unless, and this is why I'm coming back to you, it is what's called a great need. If something involves a great need on Shabbat, and a great need would be to go to sleep at night, even though it's not really a mitzvah, but it's a great need. But if you're in great shape and you go up to 20 flights, is it a great need? Rabbi Luchstein, one of my mentors and teachers, Rabbi of KJ on the East Side, he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, in Manhattan, what's a great need when it comes to an elevator? The Rav said the 5th floor. It sounds arbitrary.
It sounds arbitrary.
Now, I'm not saying you have to follow that. If you're in really good shape, 5 is not so great. But I know when I come up here, 10.
That's
so simple.
This is like 20.
I know.
The thing that makes it easier to do a mitzvah than is within this.
That's fine. But if there's no mitzvah, you need a great need in order to legitimate, to make it okay. Now, what's a great need? 5 flights, 10 flights, it's very gray. I'm telling you, it's gray. It depends on what kind of condition you're in. If God forbid you have a heart condition, the 2nd floor would be a great need. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I always recommend people to try to live on a lower floor. I'll just tell you a little story about what happened here. I asked a big rabbi when I started MJE 24 years ago. We were on the 10th floor, and I was in a room with another 30 rabbis also, and I asked Rav Schechter. He says, yeah, shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah is mutter. A rabbinic and a rabbinic, when it comes to a mitzvah, is permissible. So you can use the elevator. And I was like, oh, great. And he says, but every Shabbos? to like rely on a heter. You know what a heter is? It's like a leniency. You rely to rely on a leniency every single week. See if you can get moved down to a lower floor. So I went to the rabbi of the shul. Here was my mentor and teacher, Rabbi J.J. Schachter. He moved me down to the fourth floor. MG was on the fourth floor for the first few years. We grew out of the fourth floor. We moved to the fifth floor. We grew out of the fifth floor. We were back on 10. And that's where we are. And it's not great. That's why I've always been looking for another space as much as I love this place. So that's why it's okay to get an elevator. And that's for a mitzvah. So think about it. If you're going to your apartment for a mitzvah, you can have somebody, because you're asking someone, what? You're asking someone to do something which otherwise would be rabbinically forbidden for you, not biblically. Biblically is okay for other things. We'll get to it in a minute. Here's another thing. To prevent substantial financial loss. What's an example of this? Your air conditioner on Shabbos is plugged in. It's on. It's overheating. It's going to blow. It's not dangerous, because if it was dangerous, it would be permissible. But you know you're going to lose. You're going to have to buy a new air conditioner for $300-$400. Can you have a non-Jew turn it off so it doesn't blow?
Not if you're rich.
So no, that's a very good point. If like $300-$400 doesn't mean anything to you, but if you're a normal person and it does, then you can ask somebody to turn it off for you on Shabbat. A lot of different examples of this. Let me go through the others. Considerable pain. Why does it say considerable pain? Why doesn't it say life-threatening situation? Because a life-threatening situation...
Always.
For who? Do you even go to a non-Jew? You do it yourself. You do it yourself. You don't start looking for a non-Jew if, God forbid, somebody's in a life-threatening situation or even a question of a life-threatening situation. So I always tell this story when Yosef, who's a grown adult now, was 3, was playing with something I told him not to play with. When he was on the third floor, it was a stanchion, one of these heavy things we make our mechitzas out of, those big heavy metal things, and it came crashing down on his head. And I was on the third floor, and Rabbi Schachter was the rabbi of the Jewish Center at the time, and I saw what happened. I yelled, "Call Hatzala." Rabbi Schachter ran into the middle of the street with his talis on Shabbos. He thought it would be faster to hail a cab. Well, it was at that time, it was a while ago. It was 20 years ago. And I saw him running into the middle of the street, hailing a cab, and I ran into the cab with Yosef to go to Mount Sinai. And afterwards, I went over to him and I showed him the Rambam. The Rambam says if there's a life-threatening situation or even a question, you don't start looking for someone who isn't Jewish, or you look for somebody who's not so learned, or you look for someone who's not so religious. The biggest Torah scholar should violate Shabbos to make a point. And I said to Rabbi Schachter, "You're the biggest Torah scholar in this community, and I don't know if..." He just happened to be next to me when I yelled Hatzalah, when I screamed, "Somebody call Hatzalah," and he ran in the middle of the street and was hailing a cab in the middle of Shabbos on the middle of West 86th Street. So that was actually very appropriate. Considerable pain means you're very uncomfortable on Shabbos. You could ask your non-Jewish friend to go to the store and buy you ointment, to go take you to the doctor, whatever it is, if you're in pain. You're not in a life-threatening situation at all. You're just uncomfortable, you know. But it's a little more than uncomfortable. That's why we could take aspirin on Shabbos. If the headache is really giving you, like, you know, it's causing you to, like, have to lie down to rest. Because usually we don't take pills on Shabbat, because pills were broken up into mortar and a pestle, and they involved really a violation of Shabbat. So therefore, in general, we try not to take pills. But if it involves considerable pain, then you can take a pill, obviously, on Shabbat. If you have a medical reason to taking a pill, you can do that as well. My last one, the last one here is human dignity. It's my favorite. What's an example of human dignity? So you're coming to MJE.
Your pants split.
Yeah. However, asking a non-Jew. Now, my mother of blessed memory, I'll never forget this. One of my best friends at a wedding was dancing in front of the bride and groom, and he split his pants as he was, like, he was a big guy, and he literally split his pants as he was dancing in front of the groom. And right away, I saw him. I didn't want him to be embarrassed. So, like, I grabbed him and I started dancing with him, and then I danced him out. I'm like, "Dude, you got to get these. You got to." And my mother, blessed in memory, was at the wedding. My mother could sew well. And I said, his name is Stu. Nobody will figure out who it was. I said, he used to come to me for Shabbat. He wasn't raised like so religious, and he became religious later. We went to college together. He's a great guy. I said, I called my mother. I'm like, Stu, like, and I brought him to the bathroom. I locked him in a stall. I said, because he had literally, and I said, Mom, can you just come to the men's bathroom, find like a thing, and just, he has no other pants, and it's just like, it's bad. You know, it's like bad.
Was he drunk?
No, he's just, he really, he was doing like the Kajachka, you know, like the, he did like a split.
Not that into. Locked him in the stall, like ready to get out.
Right, there you go. So he, so anyway, so your example, by the way, my mother was sewing it. What activities involved in sewing? That's biblical. Can't ask an non-Jew to do something biblical. No, it didn't happen on Shabbos, but I'm saying.
What would you do really on Shabbat if something like this happens and you can't go out of the house now?
So you have to.
Or you're in a public place.
Right, you figure it out. You got to figure it out. So the example I like to give, so the better example is you're coming to MG on Shabbos, you have your beautiful new dress on, you're waiting at the light, and then there's like disgusting New York, you know, rainwater, and a car comes and splashes all over your beautiful new dress, and you're mortified. What do you do? You have a friend you're walking with who happens not to be Jewish. You can ask your friend, go to my apartment, go get some cash, or lay it out for me, I'll pay you back after Shabbos. Go to the store and buy me something to put on. What is involved with going to a store on Shabbos and buying something? Anything biblical? Nothing biblical, guys. It's not one of the 39 acts of work. It's masa umatan. It's business transactions. It's changing money, hands, right? That's all rabbinic. Okay? So you can ask your non-Jewish friend to do that for you on Shabbat to preserve your human dignity. The next six examples are when it's okay to do something biblical. What is settling Israel? This is interesting. Can you think of a scenario? On Shabbos, it would be okay to ask someone who isn't Jewish to do something that would enable you to settle the land of Israel, even if it involved a biblical infraction. There is such a case. Not so much today. A lot of the Arab land auctions that took place at the early part of the 20th century purposely took place on Shabbos. So Jews would not be at the auctions buying land. So people found out about this. And Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, said, there you go. You can have a non-Jew drive you in a car to the land. Why? Because what's driving? Is driving biblical or rabbinic? Okay. Biblical.
Why?
Driving is biblical because it's combustion. It's creating. It's
what about Tesla?
Yeah. Tesla electric car is not.
Really?
Yeah, electric car is not. Only electric car, you'd have even more of a leeway to do it. What's that?
Intentionally creates light. Electric car has blinkers and things that are.
Oh.
That's not like the main thing.
Doesn't matter. It's still you're still doing it though.
But that's like the
also fuel
no, it's not because there you're actually putting on.
You have to use your blinker.
You have to use the blinker to make a turn. You have to put the lights on if it's night. You're doing it for the light. You're not. It's not like an incidental result.
You could drive without the lights.
What's that?
But I think the light is not fire.
All right, whatever. I think it's a good point.
Just go straight.
I have to do a little more research. I'm not sure. Did you hear the settling of the land of Israel?
So
we we're going
to
move on.
What? In Miami, no,
yeah. So that's one. That's the only example I could ever give when it would be okay to ask a non-Jew on Shabbos. You got to do this with the thumbs now. Uh-huh. Ask a non-Jew on Shabbos to do something which would otherwise be a biblical violation if you were to do such an activity.
Which one?
Settling Israel.
Settling land of Israel. Cool. Rav Kook permitted Jews to be driven on Shabbos to land sale auctions because the mitzvah of settling the land of Israel would permit you to ask a non-Jew to drive you there. Why? What are we doing? I didn't know I was invited to this.
The
communication in this organization is pitiful.
Don't you have teacher time?
I'm teaching time.
Why are you the organization?
All right, Dana Shmashas. Guys, we got to finish up. I don't want to take more time away.
Twilight.
Twilight is a Suffolk Yom, Suffolk Lila. what is the status of twilight? Is it the next day or is it the day before? Okay, I'm not getting into that. These are, every one of these little things is a two-hour conversation. I'm just going to give you like the thing.
Yeah.
So because it's a suffix, what's a suffix means a question. When the first hour, the first 45 minutes of Shabbos is a question as to whether or not it's the next day or the day before. Therefore, it's permissible within the first 30, 40 minutes of Shabbat to ask a non-Jew to do something for the sake of Shabbos, which would otherwise be a violation of Shabbat for you. Give me an example of that. This is a nice trick for you guys to have, and you can
pick up a bottle of wine for me. I don't have one.
Certainly, I forgot to buy a bottle of wine. That's only rabbinic. That's certainly okay. Turn my heat on. I forgot to turn the heat on. Right? The Erev is down. We need somebody to fix it in the next 30, 40 minutes. Good. What else? Turn a light off or on. Or you're going to love this one. I didn't get home in time. I'm not saying you should do this. I didn't get home in time to light candles for Shabbos. And it's already Shabbos.
Are they allowed to have light it for you?
You could do that.
I'm not suggesting you do this. Can't make the bracha, but remember what the nature, what's the mitzvah of Adlakos Neiros, guys?
To benefit from the light.
To have light. They're producing light for you.
So
during that 30-minute period.
When does a new day start in the Jewish halacha? At night or in the morning?
So there's a debate about twilight. It's about a 30 to 40 minute period where some rabbis believe it's the next day, some rabbis believe it's the earlier day. Okay? So that would permit you to ask a non-Jew. I'm not saying you should rely on this. Rabbi Pinney, how would you feel about this? Now that you're here, we have a halachic authority. So I'm just saying that one of the leniencies of Amir La'akum.
Yes.
To ask a non-Jew to do something which would otherwise be of Torah violation, is Bein HaShemashos.
Yes.
Let's say you're stuck, you're going to Shabbos, you're being driven in an Uber by someone you know is not Jewish.
Yeah.
Shabbos has come, the 18 minutes, it's Shabbos.
Yeah, keep on going.
You can keep going. As long as, it's about, I said 30 to 40, but yeah. About 30? So about 30 minutes, you could still stay in the car if you're being driven.
You tell the guy to stop, have him open the door for you. If you don't open the door, and like it.
Right.
And have bring the stuff in. We shall like.
But you don't want to start, you know, oh, I got an extra 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Right, no one says you have an extra 30 minutes. It just happens to be. If you're in, you know, emergency
you
situation,
you.
What's that?
Well, you do. You already have paid for it.
But does that
right.
have to be for a mitzvah, or is it just
so you can't
in general? It has to be something for the sake of Shabbos. It can't just be, drive me to the, you know, let me get this.
Emergency.
Right. Right.
Like you got stuck in traffic, and now it's like you're on the bridge. And you're
right. Illness. Okay, number four, guys. Let's number four. Illness. Yeah, I don't want. I don't have time for psychiatry. There's just no time. Penny's got to get started. We'll do it another time. This is all your fault. Illness. What's an illness? Give me an example of an illness that it's okay. You have the flu.
COVID.
Something that really puts you into bed. COVID, a bad flu. It can't just be like a little headache, but a real headache. It could. You can ask someone who is not Jewish to do something which is otherwise biblically forbidden. If a person is a life-threatening situation, I'm not talking about life-threatening illness. Life-threatening illness, I told you the story, we do it ourselves, okay? And by the way, let's say you're visiting somebody in the hospital and they're in a life-threatening situation. You yourself could do things for them too. It'd be better to have someone who isn't Jewish, but it's okay. If they need the light on, you can put the light on. If you're in the room, the hospital room with them, and they're in a life-threatening situation. By the way, a woman in the throes of labor is considered a life-threatening situation. So she can, you can do anything for, you don't have to call a non-Jew. But this is, if you have an illness, you have like a flu, you're bedridden, so then you can have someone who isn't Jewish do anything you need for them. They can cook for you, they can, you know, blah, blah, blah. Public mitzvah. Love this. This is what is called, been referred to as the Shabbos Goy. Every synagogue has one. How do your lights get on in your shul? You think they left them on all night, Friday night? Guys, wake up.
No.
Get real. They're concerned about like the electrical bills like everybody else. So how do the lights get on? How do they get on? The non-Jew, right? Elvis Presley, documented. was a Shabbos goy. Documented, he shouldn't have been because he's probably Jewish. He was probably Jewish. Okay, mitzvah the rabbim, public mitzvah, anything that involves the public, you can ask someone who is not Jewish to do that item on Shabbos. And lastly, number six, possibility of widespread transgression. This happened to me in a hotel on Passover. The Erev goes down. People, yeah. So that,
brutal.
Yeah, so, but you can have people fix it. You can have someone who isn't Jewish fixing it, even if they're involved in any one of the 39 acts of work on Shabbat, because of the possibility of widespread transgression, people are going to just start carrying around. So you can have someone non-Jewish. So, you see, now, there are a lot of leniencies, but the leniencies do not eat up the rule. There's still a rule. The basic rule and the basic tenet is, the default is we don't rely on non-Jewish help on Shabbat. But there are a lot of times when it's okay. And that's how you get up here if you're not taking the steps. Now, you'll see people taking the steps, and you'll see people not relying on these leniencies. Okay, there's no rule that you have to rely on the leniency. The rabbis, when instituting these safeguards to ensure that the Torah's laws themselves are not violated, they put in these leniencies so it's doable. That's all. Any last questions before we finish up? Yes?
I think it's so interesting that there's so much personal, so many personal decisions to make. Like, considerable pain is a very personal idea. And then also, a substantial financial loss is very personal, depending on what you think is substantial. You could be really, really wealthy and still think $100, or still think, you could think any range of things, you know?
Yeah.
But I just find it really striking that there's so many personal decisions to make based on your feelings about
things,
and yet we're not supposed to rely on feelings.
Right, but you... No, so the feelings do come in, because when you go to a rabbi, or let's say you yourself are knowledgeable enough to answer your own question, you have to take into consideration. That's why it was not uncommon. Two people would go to Rabbi Soloveitchik with the same question. They come out with different answers. Because it depends on the person you're dealing with, their state of mind, how much they can handle, how much they can't handle. Now, but you've got operating principles that you apply to everyone, and then you have to put in the data. Anyone's went on Rabbi Pinney's halacha chat. You should. He's dealing with this stuff all the time. Yes.
Oh no, thinking about that, how you can have a legal system that's different for everyone, but leniencies can be. Then I was.
They're applied.
That's related to intention, because if you're just trying to get out of walking to the fifth floor versus.
Right.
Somebody who has a
correct. So that's
So then your intention is to get around it, as opposed to get to
look
at fourth,
In a halachically justifiable way.
Yeah.
Right, of course. All right. I'm sorry we're running a little late in the year, and I wanted to cram this in. I feel really good. I'm going to send you two questions next week. One about Bishul, one about cooking, and one about Amir La'akum, non-Jewish help on Shabbat.
Yep.
Let's just do it after, because Rabbi Pinney needs to start. Which one?
Inevitable consequence. We just want one example.
2 minutes,
guys.
You're going to
love
it.
I have a flight tomorrow.
Is it a forest fire?
Is there a little fire going towards it?
Okay, cool.
Oh, yeah, that's